Well, it's a great pleasure to welcome you all to the Glaziers Hall and to the second Leicester Exchanges live debate. This week on the topic, Comprehensive School Education, Policy Mistake, Lost Ideal or Model for the Future. My name is Bob Burgess and I'm the Vice-Chancellor of the University of Leicester and I'll be chairing this evening's proceedings. Now, I'm very pleased that we're joined by four expert panellists in the field of education and comprehensive education, and it's my pleasure to introduce from the far left here, Karen Robinson is the Head of Education and Equality at the National Union of Teachers and a keen advocate of keeping children and teachers at the heart of our educational system. At this year's annual conference, the General Secretary of the NUT described the Academies and Free Schools programme as an ideologically driven attack on state comprehensive education, which has nothing to do with the raising of standards in schools. Next to her is Bob McCartney, who is chairman of the National Grammar Schools Association, an organisation which was formed in the 1970s. The NGSA is a non-political, not-for-profit organisation concerned with the retention and promotion of the UK's grammar schools as a valuable choice for parents. He is a Northern Ireland barrister by profession and is the former leader of the UK Unionist Party and was the MP for North Down from 1995 to 2001. To my right, Melissa Benn is a writer and journalist and also campaigner for state education. She was educated at Holland Park Comprehensive School before moving on to the London School of Economics. She is a passionate supporter of state education and the movement for comprehensive reform. She is a regular contributor to The Guardian and has written many books and articles on education, including her latest book, School Wars: The Battle for Britain's Education, which has been widely reviewed recently. And then to the, my far right, Philip Cook, who is a lecturer in politics at the University of Leicester. His research considers the relationship between schooling and education and seeks to develop principles of justice for schooling independent from principles of justice for education. He is a strong believer that schools are for far more than simply delivering education. He sees them as civic institutions that should promote inclusion. Well, with that array of views and talent, let us move on to the first of our pre-submitted questions that comes from Cathy Johnson in Manchester, who asks, given free schools, academies and specialist schools, to what extent is it accurate to say that we have a comprehensive school system in the UK? And let's start with Karen Robinson.
Thank you. Well, I think we could have added to academies, free schools and specialist schools, private schools, independent schools, selective schools, grammar schools, studio schools, university technology colleges, alternative provision academies. The list goes on and on. So I think that we cannot truly say that we have a comprehensive system in this country, and that if we actually are genuinely serious about trying to have some equity in the education system, what we need to be looking at, to quote a very old phrase, are standards and not the structures. And that has been the problem. That is what has got in way of comprehensive education.
OK, thank you very much. Can we turn to Bob McCartney?
Well, Mr. Chairman, in my view, the central principle of comprehensive education is that such schools have an all-ability range of intake. Pupils in state selective schools, of which there are 164 in England and 69 in Northern Ireland, are the product of a process designed to find those children with the potential to benefit from a more intensive academic education. The overwhelming mass, my view, of state post-primary schools, whether designated comprehensive, academy-free or otherwise, have an all-ability intake, and therefore it seems reasonably accurate to infer that overall the UK has a comprehensive system. A system, may I add, which I think many of our educational woes emanate from. Only a relatively tiny minority of schools, whatever the multiplicity of their designations, represent the rest. Only grammar schools, and those grammar schools that have elected for academy status, represent a very, very small number of post-primary state schools. 4 out of 5 local education authority areas in the UK have no grammars. Yet demand for grammars, as illustrated by Kent, where there are still an island of grammar schools. In Kent in 2007, there were 1,200 applicants. In 2009, there were 1,800, an increase of 50%, indicating that there are a very large number of people who desire to have grammar schools and the concomitant selective process. But to get the proportions correct, the overwhelming mass of schools in the UK are all ability intake, and therefore, by definition, are comprehensive schools. And it seems to me that overall we have a comprehensive education system in the UK.
Fine, thank you very much. Moving on, Melissa Bell.
I'm going to approach the question. We were given these questions before, so we were all sitting at home doing our homework, coming up with our answers, and I'm going to answer the question in a slightly different way, because I thought it was a question about the coalition's policy and fragmentation of our system. And I think I hope we do get on to talk about this, that we're moving from a state education system to a state-funded system of independent, privately managed schools, which is worrying. But all those models that we talk about, those sort of fragmented models, free schools, academies, specialist schools, in some ways they pay tribute to and are elaborations of the comprehensive principle. Mossbourne, let me explain what I mean. Mossbourne, which is the most talked about school in the country. Does anybody here not know about Mossbourne and Sir Michael Wilshaw? Because if I see another item on TV about Sir Michael Wilshaw and Mossbourne, I just think there must be another school in the country. There must be another academy in the country. But Mossbourne actually pays tribute to the comprehensive principle. It's I think it's the number, it has a genuine mix of ability, it's a very ordered school, and it does very, very well. And in some ways, I think it shows that the comprehensive system, when managed properly, and I don't think it's anything to do with private sponsors, does very well. Free schools, again, Toby Young. Anybody here not heard of Toby Young? Again, the most famous free school in the country. Now, he sort of paid tribute to the comprehensive principle by calling his school a comprehensive grammar. Now, that, as somebody said, that's like calling it a vegetarian butcher. That doesn't really make sense. But he is arguing you can offer a grammar school curriculum to an all-ability intake, and it will be very interesting to see how that develops. And my own school, well, the school where my daughter's goes, is a specialist school, and that, too, is very much a comprehensive. So I think there are comprehensive elements within the model. So I think, do we have a comprehensive system? Yes and no, and let's carry on talking about the reasons why.
Okay, Phil.
Thank you very much. Well, I agree that there is tremendous segregation in our system at the moment. Many of our schools, many of our communities are deeply segregated. So even though it may say comprehensive school on the front of the building, frequently those schools are not inclusive and diverse in their composition. And that is because, as has been said previously, there is a wide range of selective private schools within the system. So from my point of view, when we think about the term comprehensive, we need to look at the value and the principle that was behind this ideal to begin with. And for me, it was very much a political and a democratic ideal, one that was focused on the value of inclusion. And I very much want to argue that for those seeking to advance the policy of comprehensive schools and the value of comprehensive schools, we must focus and we must ask, are these schools not only open to all, which they might be formally and officially, but are they in their composition integrated? Do they have a diverse community within their membership of children? And sadly, many parts of the country, particularly in large urban areas, our schools are not integrated. They are segregated. And so unfortunately, I think, you know, we should be honest that we don't have a comprehensive school system in the sense that it has substantive degrees, high degrees of integration and diversity and plurality within the student body. When we look at free schools, we look at academies, I'm sure we'll discuss this a little bit further in the evening, we can see this as an opportunity, in fact, to increase, potentially, integration and decrease segregation. But we have to focus on the admissions policies. We have to focus on the rules and the goals of those schools in terms of creating a diverse and a plural student body. So I don't think we have a very comprehensive school system at the moment. I certainly think there are fears and dangers about increasing inclusion. It seems to me that... But we also have an opportunity to promote the comprehensive ideal within this set of new structures that is currently being brought about.
Okay, thank you very much indeed. Well, let's pick up comments and questions from the floor. And if you can say who you are and where you're from. So, question in the middle.
Roger Peach is my name. In fact, I was one of the original campaigners setting up National Grammar School Association. I'm not an educationist, I'm a solicitor, actually. I think the teeth of the comprehensive proponents haven't yet got into the raw meat, because the comprehensive ideal alluded to by Philip Cook has very specific parameters, and what one is looking for, if one is a comprehensivist, is this. You're looking for schools which have a total cross-section of society in them. Have I got it right so far? They promote egalitarian views.
No.
Again, right? No.
No.
No. Equality of outcomes.
No.
Right. They promote the notion that you do not support meritocracy. Got that wrong too. Now, I'm merely throwing Professor Symes at you and halfway there and so on, and this is good old stuff. I mean, forgive me, there's not a new thought there. That's all good stuff. If you're changing direction, very interesting. But what I'm interested in is this, and here's the question. I came into this because at the time in the 70s and 80s, I was a parent. And as a parent, I wanted to be able to choose what I thought was the right school for my children. Now, if you have a complete cross-section of society in your comprehensive school, and you therefore do not have children going elsewhere into a meritocratic school like a grammar school, then you have one system. Is that not right? Now, if you have one system, and I as a parent want to go somewhere else, you would presumably want to stop me doing that.
Well, let's hear what they would say. Phil.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. And I think that your question draws on a conflation of two values, which I think are frequently... we frequently fail to separate them in these discussions, and that is between education and schooling. And I think that... everyone, hopefully, wants the best education for all children, not simply our own children. We want to give them the best resources, the best opportunities, the best teaching, so that they're able to become fully participating members of society, they're able to live productive and fulfilling lives. Much of education doesn't go on in the school. It goes on way beyond the school. It goes on in the family. People often pay for extra educational resources for their children through private tuition and so on. Education is a resource that is distributable and is you can purchase it, as it were, on the free market. Schooling is different. Schooling is to do with the membership of the community of the school. It's to do with your status and your standing in society. So the comprehensive ideal, certainly as I've understood it, was about equality, yes, equality of standing as a member of society, not in terms of the particular outcomes, educational outcomes. There will be children will have a wide variety of abilities, wide variety of interests. There may well be room and a role for selection, let's call it in inverted commas, within comprehensive schools in terms of setting or streaming. Students will certainly need different kinds of attention. They will have different interests and they will have different needs which should be attended to. And perhaps there's a role for meritocracy in that, for sure. But in terms of the membership of the institution, the civic institution of the school, yes, that's egalitarian, but that does not necessarily imply that, for example, we should have mixed ability teaching, mixed ability education. That is a separate issue.
Could I answer that, your point? Because you mentioned the question of choice, and it has always interested me as a parent when people say, give parents the right of choice, that the three systems that they always, the three kinds of schoolings that they always invoke in terms of choice don't actually involve real choice. If you don't have money, you don't have the choice to go to a private school. If you fail the 11 plus, you don't have the choice to go to a grammar school. And if you don't have faith of whatever kind, you don't have the choice to go to a faith school. So it seems to me that choice is a very strange concept in this way. I would agree with what you said, that better to have schools where all children could go to and you could have choice within the school.
Let's pick up some other views from the floor. Yes.
Realise what the essence of the grammar school's existence is. It is about selection. Yeah. And it's quite absurd, as was referred to in Bob McCartney's case, a valuable choice for parents. The majority of parents where grammar schools exist do not have the choice to say, I want my child to go to the grammar school and get that child into the grammar school. That's what happens in reality. The large majority are selected out. That's why the grammar school is what it is. It is designed to cater for a minority of a particular level of ability and inclination, not for all. That's what it's there for, and that's why there are still some areas which have them. And where they exist, the schools that might call themselves comprehensive cannot be said to be truly comprehensive, because the essence of the comprehensive is an intake of children of all levels of ability. That's why they're called comprehensive. And when I was a governor of a comprehensive school, that's it, what it was. The nearby so-called comprehensive, but now not daring to call itself that, Queen Elizabeth Boys, was so selective that kids came from all over London to try to get in. And the number of kids from Barnet who got into was a minority. So don't let's have the pretense that we're talking about parental choice. And I wish that politicians would be more on this as well, because they can express a preference in every case. They cannot express a choice which operates. That's why they are what they are. And that, it's true, we have a diverse system. We have a fragmented system. And for Toby Young to talk about a free school which is a grammar comprehensive is a nonsense.
What is your view on that?
Well, it seems to me that a comprehensive school is a school with an all-ability intake. There is no doubt whatever that the overwhelming mass of schools in the United Kingdom have an all-ability intake. Now, the European Convention on Human Rights says that a citizen has the right to an education in accordance with its philosophical or theological views. And it seems to me that day and daily a vast number of citizens in the United Kingdom are declaring that they want an opportunity to send their children to a grammar school. Why? Because they think a grammar school offers educational opportunities which are not available elsewhere. Now, 4/5 of the local education authorities covering the vast majority landmass of the UK have no grammar schools at all. Now, when we talk about choice, as the last speaker mentioned, what choice has a child in an area where there are no grammar schools and where the comprehensive schools are performing badly? Now, Professor Jessop, who is an advocate of comprehensive education, did some research, and he took the top at 11 years of age, the top 5% who were estimated to be the best in that cohort, and traced them right through until the age 17 or 18 when they were exiting, and found that under the comprehensive system, they were in limbo. They had not realized anything near their potential. And every year, there are 22,000 children in that limbo, bright, working class children who are not getting a chance. Now, why am I involved at 75 years of age with the National Grammar Schools Association? I'll tell you why. In 1948, I was the youngest of eight children living in a two-up and two-down house in West Belfast. I was the only one of the eight, by virtue of the Butler reforms, to do the first qualifying examination in Northern Ireland and to get to grammar school. It wasn't an elitist place. There wasn't a single middle-class child in it. It was completely peopled by inner-city working-class children. I went to university, grammar school, university, the bar, and ultimately, for my sins, to the House of Commons. Now, I want, in 2011, children like me to have the same opportunity which they are currently being denied. The idea that there should be imposed upon the child population of the United Kingdom one type of school smacks of a situation which in history is not a happy one. If you have a centrally controlled one form of education for everyone, you are giving a hostage to fortune.
Melissa.
Can I just say, your argument that it gives opportunity to poorer children is not borne out by the latest statistics. 2010, Bill Esterhazy, an MP, asked for statistics on the number of children on free school meals who are in year seven in grammar schools, and it's 0.4%. So, and it's 2% of ethnic minority children. So these are now clearly, I never would argue with anyone's experience, but the facts of the case today are that grammar schools educate the middle class.
But Melissa, the comprehensive schools, using the free school meals, the schools in the UK with the smallest number of children on free school meals are not grammar schools. They are comprehensive schools. Top 10 in that category are all comprehensive schools.
A question from the floor.
Yeah. Brian Lightman, I'm General Secretary of the Association of School and College Leaders, and we have members in all kinds of schools. I went to a grammar school, by the way, and I underachieved badly at that school. And I underachieved badly because of poor teaching and probably some issues around the leadership there. And I believe passionately that well-led schools with excellent teaching enable pupils to achieve. But I think about the schools I worked in. I worked for 32 years as a teacher and a head teacher. And I think about Amin, who just left my school a couple of years ago, and he actually went to Leicester University, where, coincidentally, where he is on his way to a first-class honours, having entered our school, our comprehensive school, with virtually nothing from primary school. He could hardly read, and he left us with 12 A stars at GCSE and 5 A's at A level. And that, to me, is what comprehensive education is about. It's about identifying the potential in people and enabling people to succeed. And I'm fascinated to hear the word ability used all the time, because I thought there'd been a lot of research going on into brain science recently, which shows that people aren't born with ability, that they actually can develop all kinds of abilities as they go through their education. And it's our job to challenge them. So my question really is, how would the panel define ability? If we're going to select people by ability, what do you understand by that? And how would you define it?
I mean, first of all, in terms of Robert, you said relatively small number of grammar schools in England. And I think the discussion really is more about England than Wales and Scotland, for example, where you don't have the grammar schools at all. And I don't think we should get into mistaking the UK and England, two separate things. Okay, a fifth of local authorities have grammar schools, but the washback effect on other secondary schools is incredible. recent estimate, 75% of secondary schools in England are affected by having grammar schools in a neighbouring local authority, leave alone in their own one. So I think that that is a devastating effect, which I really think you minimalised. And I think also that you skirted in danger very much of conflating comprehensive equals bad standards. And I'd hoped that we'd been able to sort of pass that. As Brian said, good schools exist with excellent leadership, with good teaching, with dedicated staff. It is not about the kind of school that you have. As somebody who taught in comprehensive and fully comprehensive schools in the northwest of England before I started work for the NUT, I know that it is very hard work to do, that you have to believe that every child has the ability, you have to work with them, you have to find their particular learning style, the way to relate to them. You cannot do the kind of drilling, let's say, or more traditional passive forms of teaching and learning that goes on actually in many of the grammar schools, where the focus is on making sure that you get your best possible result in the league tables. True comprehensive schools offer a range of curricular, academic and vocational that bring out the best in each child. And surely parents want the child to have the best possible chance to make the most of their potential and be seen as individuals. That's not something that necessarily, I think, is a strength of grammar schools. It's far more of a strength of comprehensive schools. I think also, and the point about higher education that you mentioned, some research that came out last year from the Sutton Trust showed that students who went to comprehensive schools and who gained 3 Bs at A levels actually outperformed in terms of their final first degree subject by quite a considerable amount compared to private and grammar school pupils who had got 2 A's and a B. So I think it's absolute nonsense to suggest that somehow comprehensive school pupils have less ability or less potential. I think in the past it actually was a real millstone for many people growing up in the 60s and 70s who had failed the 11 plus and were somehow seen as second class citizens and written off straight from the start. Do we really want to go back to a situation where 10% of the population, if that, were going on to HE, where 49% of people were leaving school with no qualification at all? Is that really what we're saying would be good for this society? Because I really cannot agree.
Well, yeah. Phil, are these views you share on your experience of higher education?
It's certainly the case that our school system should be enabling children to have the widest possible choice of good universities, and of course our universities should be able to be inclusive and to take children from a very wide range of backgrounds for the benefit of all of us, not least those teaching universities, to have a wide range of students to interact and to learn from. So I certainly agree with much of what was said earlier. I do want to just return briefly to a couple of things. One is from the gentleman asked the first question, and it seemed to be part of his concern was, should we force, if you like, should we have compulsory mixing and integration within schools? And it seems to me, you know, yes, I'll try and be explicit about it, yes. And here's the answer why, here's the justification for it. Because we live within a plural society. Our democracy, our civic society, is made up of a whole range of different people from different backgrounds. And there's many good reasons why it's important for children in particular to be able to integrate and to learn from and to be able to learn to respect everyone and to be respected by everyone. And so admissions policies such as fair banding, where schools are required to have a representative intake from their local communities and not just those who apply to that school, is imperative. Just as we allow everyone to stand for election, we allow everyone to participate in politics and to have a vote and so on, we want a wider diversity of people. This is the lifeblood of our civic society. And so I hope that sort of answers your question sort of explicitly. And then just to come back to something Robert McCartney said, I think that it seems as though you were worried about having one type of school, and as though comprehensives are all one type of school. Well, it seems to me that the name of the school, whether it's called comprehensive or it's called academy or free school, really doesn't tell you much about the character and the nature of that school. And it seems to me, of course, we want plurality. We want different kinds of schools that will have a different ethos, perhaps. They will have different specialisms. They will have their own characteristics, certainly to do with the leadership, and the particular qualities of the management. And so a plural school, to be in favour of the comprehensive system in terms of being in favour of integration and a plural student body, does not mean that you want one single kind of school that will be sort of uniform and identical.
Respect, Philip, if we want to communicate, we have to have some definition of terms. And if we're going to define a comprehensive school, it seems to me that the usual definition is an all-ability intake, which seems to be separate. You can't then fly off and say there are a myriad of different schools within this. But I want to reply to a piece of grossly inaccurate statement that has been made by my colleague here on my left, and that is that where you have grammar schools, they skim off all the bright surrounding children and they leave secondary moderns in a destitute state. This was intensively researched by Durham University study in 2008. It said, "We have also failed to find any evidence of collateral harm to any other schools arising from the existence of grammar schools." That's a piece of objective, rational research. And as for neuroscience, that has been extensively researched in the United States, and the leading researchers refer to it as the equivalent of selling snake oil as a total nostrum for problems.
Sorry, can I? Yeah, I just wanted to read something from. I'm quoting from my own book only because it's a long-ish quote. This is Becky Matthews, who's a parent campaigner against the 11 plus in Kent, and this is how she describes the system: your marvellous grammars and then your well-regarded secondary moderns. If you are a child in Kent, you will be labelled by a test at 10 years old. You will be educated in a school exclusively populated by middle-class, prosperous children, or you will be educated in a school populated by children who have failed, probably with a disproportionate number of special education needs students and emotional and behavioural difficulties, with little or no sixth form or second-rate facilities. These outcomes are largely determined by social class. Your position is not sustainable politically because there is no, correct me if I'm wrong, there is no mainstream political party apart from UKIP that now advocate the return of grammars. I think that our political class is stuck. They can't. They're like that Michael Rosen story. They can't go forward, they can't go back, because they can't go through the middle. They can't actually move forward and create a genuine non-selective system, but they won't go back to what you want. But they won't also get... They won't phase out the selection that exists. And until somebody is bold enough in the political system to do that, we're going to be stuck having this debate forevermore, won't last that long.
Let's pick up some more views and move on to a question that was submitted by Adrian Morley from Cambridge, who says, to what extent do the panel agree with the view of Lord Adonis, former Labour Minister in the Department of Education, who said, and I quote, comprehensive schools have largely replaced selection by ability with selection by class and house price? Melissa.
Let me say why I don't agree with it before I come on to the really serious point. It, to me, it's always a cynically used argument. It's a way of attacking comprehensives. It's always that only the rich can do well because you have to move into an affluent area. I think you have to be very rich to move house for a school. I mean, today there was an interview with Philip Gould, who was Blair's advisor, in the paper. He was so rich he could move to send his children to a good state school. Most people can't. And in fact, when the Daily Telegraph ran a piece recently about people moving to high-performing schools, they were talking about private and grammars. That's where people move. But I think it also, the more serious point, is it ignores that in many areas, comprehensives do work well, and they draw on socially and residentially mixed areas. And they do, so they work where they're work well there. And in my own area, interesting, which is quite an affluent area, the comprehensive itself is very much an inner city comprehensive. It's sort of only 20% of the pupils are white. It's very mixed, sort of high amount of special needs. So even when people live in affluent areas, they don't necessarily choose to support the state schools. But the serious question is, we do have residential segregation in this country, and that does affect schooling. And I think what you need is you need government to take measures. And the OECD call this horizontal segregation, and their answer, and their terribly moderate body, is that you put resources into poorer areas, which Mossbourne has done. You give them the best teachers, you bring up the quality of the schooling, and you find ways to create fair banding and good mixed intakes. And I think it's just something, if we had a government that really put their mind on that, I think parents would be so much less anxious, and I think our system would further improve.
So, Bob, where do you stand on
this?
Well,
there is no doubt in my mind, and I want to see that the dreaded name of Adonis has been brought into the equation. To quote from what he actually said, grammar schools formally open to all who were bright enough by Butler's Act enabled a proportion of working class children to mix with their similarly able middle class peers. The challenge for the next generation was to widen access to grammar schools. The comprehensive revolution tragically destroyed much of the excellent without improving the rest. Comprehensive schools have largely replaced selection by ability with selection by class and house price. Now, the truth of the matter is that the great ideal of comprehensive education, which was flagshipped by Tony Crosland, actually had a fatal flaw, because the flaw in his arguments did not recognise the advantages that come from a middle-class background could not simply be negated by abolishing grammar schools. The truth is that all the most successful comprehensive schools are largely, not entirely, but largely in areas of social affluence where there is a respect for parental and pedagogical authority. And that is the reason why those comprehensive schools have the lowest percentage, not grammar schools, they have the lowest percentage of free school meal children. But apart from anything else, the free school meal test is the most utterly inappropriate and blunt instrument for deciding, because a child is on free school meals doesn't invest it necessarily, though it may do, with the ability to benefit from an intensive academic education. Now, you know, the whole argument seems to me that people, many, many people, are saying, we want an education for our children in accordance with what we believe to be their ability, in accordance with what we believe to be our philosophical objective. I believe that it is for that reason that there is great competition to get into grammars, and undoubtedly a lot of money spent on coaching, and there is great competition to get into good comprehensive schools in areas where there are no grammars. And that means, if necessary, purchasing a house. Now, this has been done, and despite what Melissa might think, Chiara Cavalieri, on the 28th of August 2011, in The Independent on Sunday, did a detailed analysis of this. It runs, I won't bore you with the details, but the upshot is that on average, to buy a house or acquire a house in the catchment area for an excellent comprehensive, and there are excellent comprehensive schools, is in the region of £77,000 over the value of a house that is not in such a prime condition.
So, Karen, where do you stand on this?
Well, I found something I think that I agree with here, which is great. There is certainly a lot of, I think, of reform needed in terms of admissions procedures where schools are their own admissions authorities, because it's those subtle little ways that things can be put forward to parents. For example, Toby Young's free school, compulsory Latin until you're 14, you can imagine that going down very well with a certain crowd, can't you? So by subtle means, it is possible, I think, to give out a message that you may or may not be welcome in a certain sort of school. Where we disagree again, I feel, is that your suggestion that only the selective
comprehensives were doing well. Well, actually, this year, in the 2011 GCSE, the highest improving school, Perry Beaches, which is in Birmingham, and it's an area that I know well, certainly not house prices anywhere near the sort that would attract in London, not a very nice area at all, 40% plus free school meals, a wide variety of languages spoken. That is the fastest improving school in England this year. Previous year, Phoenix in London, in Tower Hamlets, again, very deprived community and a genuine comprehensive. Phoenix High School. So again, very, I think, again, we're bordering on doing down comprehensive schools and the potential that they have. Also, I was a little bit unclear about what you said in terms of free school meals and that meaning that children wouldn't benefit from an academic education.
I can perhaps clarify that. I'm simply saying that using free school meals as an indicator of whether any particular child would benefit from a particular form of education is a very blunt instrument. Undoubtedly, within the corpus of free school meal children, there are some very bright children. But there are also some very, in fact, statistically, the majority of them would be not so bright.
A comment from the lady just on the aisle. Yeah.
My name is Marie Stewart, and I'm a psychologist, and I work in the field of diversity and equality. I'm terribly sorry, but I'm having great difficulty understanding the case that Robert McCartney is making. It seems to be quite contradictory. And I think if he could spell out exactly what the case is that he's making for grammar schools. I'm sure I'm not the only person that's had difficulty with some of the comments which seem almost eugenic, not to mention some of the comments about selection in comprehensive schools. What exactly are you saying is the benefit of a grammar school?
There are 164 grammar schools in the United Kingdom. And some research was done by the statistical body that deals with schools. Those 164 grammar schools in the difficult subjects, which the Russell Group of universities are now demanding, produced in terms of A and B in physics, chemistry, maths and modern languages, 164 schools produced the same number of A's and B's in those difficult subjects as 1,500 comprehensives. So what I am about is saying that if we're looking for quality, if we're looking for those children who can do the sort of academic subjects that economically this country needs, then I am for grammar schools.
It's the creation of an elite, that's what it is.
I've got a couple of points. Firstly, if anything good can come out of this, can I please request that there is no mention of GSEs or secondary moderns, because from my understanding, they haven't existed for many decades. And if this is your understanding, Robert McCartney, then I'm a bit worried about what decade you're living in. Right, to the main point. You come down to Kent and you meet the people in the grammar schools there, and you will find, as mentioned by Melissa Benn, that they are mostly middle class. You will find that the people who have the choices are the middle class people who will, if their child does not get into the grammar school, they will send them to the private school. And those are their two choices. And the people who can't get their children into the grammar school and can't afford the private school will go to very poor comprehensives because of the other types of school. Come down and have a look. Now, I understand that your situation might be different in Northern Ireland or when you were going to school, but this is a fact. In the grammar school I went to, there were two people in my school year who had free school meals out of 140. And the rest were people who were very well off, who could have otherwise gone to a private school, but their parents chose not to send them. This is completely anti-widening participation. The Russell Group universities and 1994 Group universities are all talking about widening participation, all attempting to do it. And it doesn't appear to me like it's got down to the school level. You're saying that some people are not suited to a grammar school education because they have school meals. No. All it means is that they are poor. It doesn't mean anything else. It means they don't have any money. That's all it means.
Well, let me answer your question. In Northern Ireland, there is a selective system. There are grammar schools, secondary modern, and secondary modern schools. Northern Ireland gets the best GCSE and the best A-level results in the United Kingdom and does so year after year after year. But a more important statistic is that 42% of the students that it sent to university from Northern Ireland are from the lowest economic levels, as compared to 29% from the comprehensive system in England. So whatever your experience in Kent, what I can tell you is that in an area where there are no comprehensive schools as such, they're getting excellent academic results, and they are demonstrating a far greater degree of upward social mobility from those sections of the community that are economically disadvantaged.
So, well, no, why are the Catholic Principals Association, that represents, I think, most of the heads of secondary and primary schools in Northern Ireland, are totally against the grammar system, which you haven't mentioned, but is being phased out? You know, in a way, we can argue statistics back and forth. Grammars obviously are going to do well. They take the well off. They give them privilege. They're like the next layer down to the private schools. And they're just mimicking that. And one of the problems we have with the comprehensive project is that we're always having to shape ourselves around what is, you've made very clear, an elite system and an elite ideology. And we can argue about the statistics, but I think it is about a profound difference in worldview. Are we a society that wants to do well for all our children, or are we a society that wants to do well for those who have been already born, in effect, with privilege and so on? And I just think it's an unbridgeable gulf. And I think our politicians, as I've said, secretly, it's not that they agree with you, but they're afraid to challenge your elitism. And they're afraid to challenge... No, let me... You have said a lot. And they are afraid to challenge the elitism of the... Nobody mentions the private schools. And the private schools are such a problem in our society. I was late coming here, final point. Really nice taxi driver, Bulgarian, moved here. He said, I like it here, I miss my family, blah, blah. I often have this conversation, and I thought, I know what's coming. The trouble is our schools. The state schools are rubbish. And I said, well, I'm just about to go to a debate on education. I don't think that's right, but I was a woman in a taxi, who didn't listen to me. I said, where do you get your ideas the state schools are rubbish? She said, the radio. And do you know what? We have a real problem. That's another thing we don't talk about. We have a real problem with the media in this country, and it does relate to the private schools, because most of the people who run our means of communication go privately. They don't understand this, and they will have more respect for you than I do for them, actually.
Comment from over in the middle here.
First of all, I want to say that one reason, and I accept that grammar schools in Northern Ireland are very successful schools, one reason why they are particularly successful is because there are very few independent schools in Northern Ireland.
None.
And that is none at all. So you have the full range of pupils coming there. But I do want to say, from my experience of being a principal advisor in Kent for 6 years, that to suggest that secondary modern schools do as well as other schools is frankly preposterous. In the National Challenge, we had more schools in Kent, very successful, very good schools, very well-run schools in National Challenge than other schools, simply because of the intake to those schools wasn't as high. The second point is that it is a clear fact that most grammar schools in Kent have a very small number of pupils who take free school meals. The strongest argument, and it puzzles me that you haven't advanced this argument, is that, as Melissa Benn has pointed out, the fact of the independent schools in this country leads heads of grammar schools in Kent to feel that they are providing a state route to an independent education. And that is something, it is a strong argument, and it puzzles me that you haven't mentioned this. But the consequence of that drive is that, in my belief, working class children and many children, the 75% who don't go to grammar schools, simply lose out, and overall we have less success. I have to finish by saying that because of the extraordinary strength of the heads in secondary moderns in Kent, we do actually in Kent do well compared to other schools. But that does not match the international PISA information, which suggests that in those schools which have selection, those countries do less well. And Finland's been mentioned, Canada's been mentioned. If you look at those countries that do best, they have comprehensive type of education.
Well, you see, if I can deal with the Finnish thing, which is very often canvassed, and I have friends who have children at school in Finland, and the problem with Finland is the middle ranges do very well, but they have a problem with the top end. The brightest children are not being, and it is felt in Finland, effectively catered for. Now, you mention about the secondary modern schools in Kent and their difficulties. The national average for secondary modern schools in the UK, and they do not have the benefit of the top 20% or 25% that go to a comprehensive, is only marginally below that of the comprehensive schools. Secondly, as I referred earlier, the research that has been done, intensive research in Durham University, confirms that in their view there was absolutely no evidence that the presence of a grammar school in any way prejudices surrounding secondary schools. And I did mention, of course, two schools, specific schools, that are in an area of grammar schools, secondary moderns, that are outperforming by far the national average. Now let me make one further point,
them?
Just a moment, Melissa, about Kent. Of the 10 worst performing post-secondary schools in the UK, two of them are in Kent and two of them are newly found academies converted from comprehensives. Both of them having less than 12% of their pupils getting 5 GCSEs, including A to C, including English and maths.
We just have to say that you talk about comprehensives failing. There are so many different kinds according to the selection that goes on around. So you can't just look at a comprehensive without looking at the socioeconomic surrounds of that school. And it's just a nonsense.
Question right to the back.
I'm probably going to make myself very unpopular with my fellow teachers here, but I actually teach in a grammar school at the moment, having taught in comprehensives and in pupil referral units in the past. Just picking up on Melissa Benn's last comment, I think the point that in LEAs in which you have grammar schools and you then have comprehensives, those comprehensives aren't prejudiced, that's largely due to the fact, certainly in London, that the authorities that still maintain grammar schools, Sutton, Bexley, yeah, Kingston, are incredibly, by London standards, are incredibly affluent. And often what will happen is many students from out of borough, certainly at the school I teach at in Sutton, London Borough of Sutton, many schools from out of borough, from Croydon, from Wandsworth, from Southwark, from Lambeth, will leave those boroughs to come to a grammar school. And the competition, therefore, means that very bright students don't get into the grammar school locally, but they then go to their local. They then go to the local comprehensives. So the point, I can't stress highly enough how much, as a teacher, I agree with Melissa Benn's point about socioeconomic backgrounds. You can't blame the comprehensive sector for the very, very, very acute socioeconomic problems that you see in some of the Kent coastal towns. It would take a titanic effort to raise. You use those statistics as if that is solely an indictment of the education system. Those statistics are an indictment of a huge growth in inequality in the post-war era that means that even the best comprehensives with the most dedicated staff, the most effective management, couldn't hope to turn around some of the socio-economic issues in the areas they operate.
So let's hear which of the panel agree with your views. Phil?
The grammar school question is obviously very divisive and Robert's great passions, but in many ways I want to sort of defend Robert McCartney and the Grammar School Association and praise them for how explicit and transparent they are about their selective and selection policies. And that is, from the point of view of democracy, from the point of view of accountability, so important. And you know, we can have many arguments about the social consequences of this form of selection, but it is explicit and it is transparent. I think what is at the truth of Lord Adonis's point here, and has been mentioned a few times, is the opaque and is the unaccountable and is the hidden selection that is going on in so many of our schools. And I think in many ways the fight shouldn't be between the grammar schools and those who support comprehensive, and there is an argument obviously to be had there, we're rehearsing it now, but the threat and the danger is from this insidious and this hidden and this sort of backdoor selection. I think I would certainly like to advocate for those who care about the health of our democracy, who care about the health of our polity, that the first thing that should be argued for and should be put in place is just transparency in admissions policies and selection policies, whatever they may be. Then we can have this kind of argument and we can bring in the facts, we can bring in our values and so on, but it's the lack of transparency and accountability that is so dangerous.
Didn't you mention earlier, Philip, that in your wide-ranging view of the multiplicity of possible schools, you did mention banding and SETI as acceptable. But in a sense, although you're taking everyone in, you are simply deferring the point at which you make a selection about the type of education that will be offered to a specific band. But I want to return to the question questioner down here. One of the reasons for it, and for the pressure that you rightly describe about middle-class parents, is, broadly speaking, and this is a generalisation, there are more aspirational parents among the middle class than there are in large sections, particularly in the inner cities, of what is not even a working class, what is a dependency class. And the answer to the problem of the pressure on schools, and you mentioned Sutton. Wallingford High School, Girls High School in Sutton, has 180 places. 1,600 parents submitted their children for the examination. 650, I think it is, passed the examination, but 400 plus who had demonstrated that they could avail themselves of a grammar school education didn't get a place. Now, the answer to the problem, which the current government and other governments have denied, is the opening of additional grammar schools to give people the choice. And I think if there were more grammar schools, there would be less pressure.
I think if you have a divided system where you either have the schools that are well regarded and do well and the schools that aren't, of course parents are going to apply for the one and not the other. But if you, I can equally offer you polling evidence which says that 90% of parents want a good local school. That's what they want. And I mean, if they're being offered something that's so divided, they might go towards yours. But I think if they were equally offered a sort of good, high-performing comprehensive or even Mossbourne, dare we mention it, I think they would vote with their feet and choose that. So I don't think the oversubscription of grammar schools proves a point in a divided system. But we didn't answer the question on ability, which I think is interesting. And obviously, you point out very right, there is a paradox there, but we don't want to recognise ability in terms of selection, and yet we talk about mixed ability classes and setting, which does. And the only thing I'd say there, because we can go round this point over and over again, is that I think some of the most exciting work coming out of educational thinking now is something that's going to make you keel over when I say it, is something called learning without limits, which is a point of view that puts less emphasis on defining the learner and more emphasis on the joy and process of learning. And there is a primary school in Hertfordshire called Wroxham where they completely refuse to label anyone level 4, level 3, level 2, gifted and talented or anything. And that school is in special measures. They use learning without limits and it is by all formal standards an outstanding school, but it has a completely different culture because it doesn't define children. I think our system, whether it's state, comprehensive academy, free school, it defines children all the time and it links to social class. And I think it would be great if we could move into a different, more exciting way of educating people. I do not expect you to travel there with
well,
us.
Well, Melissa, have you read Diane Ravitch's book, Left Back?
I've read a lot of Diane Ravitch's work.
Well, if she you read her Left Back, it's a century of failed reforms in American education. And a vast number of them are being, those failed reforms are being tried here. As a special commissioner that was put into New York to deal with the failing public schools, that is state schools in New York, discovered, he said, there are new reformed progressive initiatives being put into the schools in New York, which if they were pharmaceutical products, the people who were proselytizing them would be prosecuted.
Yes,
and there is absolutely no doubt that one of our problems, and we hear Melissa talk about this wonderland, you know, where everybody's doing anything. But when you try, they tried this in Boston. They went, they put a whole team of progressive educationalists into the schools in Boston, teacher's desk at the back. They weren't to be taught or led in education. They were to be involved in a journey of finding their own way in this education. After 3 months, the desk was back at
Robert,
the front.
Sorry.
The desk was back at the front, and the kids were back in their seats.
Sorry, Robert, I'm a parent, and I know you need a bit of order, and I think progressive ideas work well in a context of order. So that's one debate. The other is, don't let's leave the audience with the view Diane Ravitch. Diane Ravitch is one of the... She was a Bush advisor who has turned against the whole charter school, privatisation, billionaire philanthropists coming in, dividing the state system, undermining it. She is a great defender of American public education, so... I don't want you to leave me with the wrong impression.
She wouldn't go along with most of the ideas.
No, she's not. She's but she's a defender of public education.
Well, we've had a wide range of views represented this evening. Let's get back to the question that we started to frame our debate. Comprehensive school education, policy mistake, lost ideal or model for the future. I'm going to turn to each of the panellists to briefly sum up and to give their views on that particular question. Karen.
Okay. I think it's a shame that within the title there wasn't success story, actually, something a little bit more positive, because I certainly think that comprehensive education is the way forward. I think we need to look at the international evidence. Government at the moment is very keen on learning from the best performing countries, best performing education systems. And the OECD, which is certainly not a left-wing progressive organisation, is very clear that in terms of economic efficiency and contribution to economic growth, true comprehensive systems are the ones which are better in terms of the highest overall outcomes for children, but also the smallest gap or tail of underachievement. So there is certainly more equity in terms of children's achievements and what they can go on to contribute to society. To be able to do that, there has to be an equal distribution of resources, particularly in terms of quality of teachers. That's found to be a key resource within schools. And if you have certain schools which drain the best qualified teachers, that obviously has a negative impact. Teacher-pupil relationships is also found to be a very significant factor in raising achievement across the piece. And obviously having funding which is not filtered out to certain favoured types of schools. It's really unfortunate that we haven't had an opportunity really to come on to talk about the effect that academies and potentially free schools may also have on the system. I had a mention of it over there. I'm afraid there won't be a Karen Robinson free school anytime soon, because I think that potentially this is the next real threat to undermining a democratically local accountable school system, which comprehensive education has been really at the forefront of, engaging all the stakeholders in the community in terms of getting involved in education.
In many ways, I'm going to say the same thing. Is it a lost ideal? Absolutely not. I think it is an ideal that has been vindicated, if not triumphed. And in a way, don't take this personally, I think Robert McCartney speaks from our past, the post-1944 settlement that broke down under parental pressure. It was a Tory government that recognised that you could not sustain a system that divided children at 11. And that was why we had the introduction of the comprehensive system, which... You know, policy mistake also suggests that it was something brought in by some Stalinist Labour person, should there ever be such a radical creature. It was, in fact, a very slow-moving reform that came from local authorities, chief officers of education, and, as I say, from parental pressure. So, to me, it is... And Leicestershire. And so it's a vindicated ideal. And in a way, I think we have been talking about the past in this very interesting discussion, because I think the future is more worrying. And this is to pick up Karen's point. I think we have a government that is elitist, well, the Tory part of it. It's the most politicised government I've ever experienced in my several decades of life now. Go on the Department of Education website, there is not a mention. They list types of school, comprehensives and community schools are no longer listed by this government. It is a government that doesn't practice transparency except in a rather confusing way, and it worries me greatly. And I think what they want to introduce is a tripartite system of a subtle kind. I think they want the local ecology of schools to be, every parent will know, you will like it because it would be choice for you, would be, there would be the de facto grammar, which will be the faith schools or the high comprehensives in affluent areas or certain academies like Mossbourne. Then you will have the de facto secondary modern, which will be the academies without funding or without a certain mixed pupil population. And then even the return of studio schools, technical schools, which is, that was the original idea of the Norwood definition that led to the 1944 Act. Do we want that? No. I think we have to go along the route that the OECD points us to, and why Michael Gove, who seems to like Andrea Schleicher and says he's a marvellous man, the chief guy at OECD, never takes any notice of what he says. And what he's saying is clear: autonomy at school level, but a fair national system. So it's not a lost ideal, not a policy mistake, definitely a model for the future, but we need bolder. And, you know, we just need politicians who are prepared to take the steps that we need to take. And whether that's going to come from the much maligned post-New Labour Party, I don't know. But that's what I'm campaigning for.
If ever comprehensive education was an ideal, it is certainly lost. I believe... intellectually, it was designed to undermine conservative values which people like Tony Crosland thought for the future would be best for the Labour Party. We spoke about Diane Ravitch earlier. One of her fundamental principles after examining reforms for a century in America was the conclusion that the function of schools is to educate. It is not to propagate any political, economic, or social ideology. Yet this is exactly what the comprehensive system did. It moves from equality of opportunity, a liberal doctrine, whereby children who demonstrated that they could benefit from a certain form of education, to a Marxist principle. Equality of results. I mean, you laugh, but the guru, the man who really wrote the definitive volume about comprehensive education, Hargreaves, you want to read some of his statements, that what teachers have got to do is obtain not teaching skills, but political skills, that parents have no inalienable right to use their funds to provide an education for their children. It has got to be overruled that everybody has got to have the same. I mean, in a democracy, if a successful footballer can use his money to buy himself a Maserati, are we really saying, as Hargreaves said, that people with funding should be prevented from using their money in a much more laudable cause, the best education that, in their view, they can provide for their children?
When was Hargreaves elected by him?
Well, Hargreaves wasn't elected, but he and people like Brian Smith are the theorists upon which much of the whole comprehensive system was erected. The truth is that merit, competition, testing, selection all became anathema to the lobbyists for social equality. The Marxist principle was not equality of opportunity, it was equality of results. There is no other form of human endeavour, whether it be from a football college to an athletic college, where you say, sorry, you're a terrific person, but you're not a good enough athlete to join our school, or you're not a good enough footballer to join our college. Life is about competition. You cannot negate it. You cannot remove it. Our communities are on equal places. Now, we should do our best to level the playing field, but to assume that you can, by some form of propagation of an ideology, economic, political or social, that you can change our educational system and make it better, is just a fallacy. The truth is, we have Sir Terence Leahy saying that the products largely of the comprehensive systems aren't fit to stack shelves because they can't read count.
And a final
or you have Sir Stuart Rose, the same, or the CEO of the small businesses. All of these people are saying the comprehensive education system is not producing children educated fit for purpose.
And a so final brief comment from Phil. Okay.
So the question is, what kind of model for the future could comprehensives provide? Now, it seems for those who support the comprehensive ideal, we have to somehow square the circle of embracing choice, embracing plurality, which is coming and seems to be in strong demand from parents, and supporting the value of integration and comprehensive schools. So how do we answer that question? If we don't value integration, and if we don't take care that these new schools, free schools and academy converters will become selective, we're going to become an extremely segregated society, not along the lines of ability, which is not really the main problem. It's along lines of ethnicity, along lines of religion, along lines of class. And so how can we embrace choice and how can we embrace integration? Well, my suggestion is, for all those who care about this and for any of you who are interested in sort of taking this forward, we should focus with a steely eye on the issue of admissions. And we should be very careful to campaign for these new schools not to be their own admissions authorities, where they can operate a sort of hidden form of selection, that selection should be on the basis of fair banding, that selection should be in the hands of politically accountable organisations and institutions. But we could still have a plurality of schools with different ethos, different character, different identities, and we can therefore hopefully offer choice, which is something to be celebrated, but also ensure that we support the value of integration and stop our society becoming increasingly segregated.
Well, clearly, comprehensive education and the question of selection has been at the heart of educational debate for over 60 years, and indeed, this evening is no exception in terms of the extent to which it continues to be debated by policymakers, politicians, researchers, and practitioners, among others. It's very encouraging that it's an area, despite our differences, that we find interesting to debate the philosophical issues as well as the practical issues. It just remains for me to thank all the people on the panel and indeed those people who participated in the debate. Thank you very much indeed.